Practice, and my guest today is a name that I had heard over my career, throughout my career, but it's a gentleman who started here in Tucson, Arizona with the Pima County Sheriff's Department and now teaches all over the world. He is the author of the book Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement, Dr. Kevin Gilmartin. Okay. Well, my guest this morning, and I'm very honored to have you here, sir, is Kevin Gilmartin. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. You're going to definitely have to get a little bit closer, bring that to you. There you go. All right. So I was trying to remember how or why you and I were put in contact with one another. I think it was Lillian George, but I'm not entirely sure. But I've said this, and I'll gush a little bit, but throughout my career, I started in 1998. I retired in 2019. There are several names within the law enforcement community that you can mention, and regardless of what agency you work for, people will recognize the name. And so you're one of those gentlemen from law enforcement in the state of Arizona, at least from my perspective.
Well, thank you for saying that. I don't know if having your name mentioned is always a good thing because they don't know what context they're putting it in. Nah. I'm sure there's lots of people like me, but I'm sure there's an equal number of people that wish I wasn't born, but that's okay.
But you and I don't make it through 20 years in law enforcement without having very, very thick skin. So some people have called me by the wrong name, and I was like, you know what? I've been called worse. I'm fine. Just don't call me late for dinner and we'll be just fine. So, I'm absolutely honored. And, I thank you. You brought me, one of your books, a copy of your book, Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement. And I understand that you just got back into town yesterday.
Well, I'm a Tucson boy. I was raised in Tucson, went to work here at the Pima County Sheriff's Department many, many years ago. But when I retired, I moved to Oregon, and I'm there half the year, and I come back to Tucson. So by far, I do much more professional work as a law enforcement behavioral science person in Oregon than I do in Arizona. So if you ask me where my home is, it's 50-50.
So kind of going along with the prompts, because I definitely want to make sure we make plenty of time to talk about what you've done since you've retired and what you were doing before you retired. But growing up in Tucson, like, how do you even pick law enforcement? Was that in your family or was it just something you decided?
Well, law enforcement is in my family.
Okay.
My family came from Ireland and came to the United States. And when they landed in New York, the typical immigrant story, most of them stayed in New York. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, my folks went to Arizona. So
no better place for fair-skinned individuals.
Yeah, I know. Well, the dermatologists have to have something to make a living. But my family that stayed in New York, they classic Irish American immigrant story. They became cops, and their kids became cops. And my cousin just retired as a 2-star chief from the New York City Police Department.
Wow.
And his brothers and sisters are NYPD, and their kids are NYPD.
Oh my gosh!
So when I watch the show Blue Bloods, I'm thinking, that's the family. There must be 40 of them that are all related.
You know, I wouldn't say that I had a bad career, but the fact that neither one of my children want to go into law enforcement is totally fine with me.
Well, you know, I will say law enforcement, when I entered it a long, long time ago, was a much different profession than it is today.
Yeah.
In some ways, today's profession, you know, the technology's improved, the levels of skill sets and officer safety expertise has improved.
Yeah.
But it's a tough time to be a cop right now in 2023, and many cities are destroying their police departments. And if I had kids of that age, I would obviously, like every old cop says, become a firefighter. But the levels of just jeopardy that cops are in today is tough, which actually feeds back into what I do for a living, and that's to teaching cops how to emotionally survive this tough, tough job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was simpler. You know, if somebody did wrong, you arrested them, you went to jail. And
right.
you didn't have to learn, didn't have to assess what their whole ideology was, whether you had yeah. a right to arrest them or not. But
one of the examples that I give is I remember as a brand new deputy, there was another guy that was, I worked midnights. There was a guy on swing shift. He's trying to pull a car over and it's not stopping. It finally stops for him. I'm flying over there, lights and sirens, to go back him up. When I arrive, the driver is sitting there and he's asleep at the wheel snoring. And the other guy's back there running his license plate. Well, he wasn't snoring. It was agonal breathing. And what we think is that the guy was trying to hurry up and get home because he realized there was something going on. So we extract him from the car. We call for paramedics. And then I'm giving him sternum rubs. He's coming back too. But then he goes back down. And this just goes on until paramedics come. They scoop him. They take him away. That guy does not make it. I guess he had a heart attack or something was going on. But I mean, that was kind of the expectation is should he go down and be completely unresponsive, I would start CPR and start praying that paramedics get there. And then just within a year or two of retiring, there was a shooting here in town where a gentleman set his house on fire, went over, shot some ambulance drivers, goes back to his house. TFD is now there. He shoots at them. Then he flees from there. And as he's fleeing, he T-bones one of the Tucson police officers who spins out. And as he's jumping out of his car, now that guy is shooting at him. He returns fire, kills that gentleman, but then runs over and starts. It's above basic life support. It's above BLS. It's sucking chest wound bandages and putting in blood clotting thing. You know what I mean? Like he's, sure. And here's a gentleman who just literally tried to kill him. And now he's saving his life or trying to.
Well, you know, cops are a special breed, you know, and it's, you know, my life's work has been helping cops, trying to help yeah. cops. And that story, you would find cops doing stuff like
yes,
that. You
yeah.
find cops doing things that are absolutely amazing. One of the things that I think of is absolutely amazing is just simple little things over the years you see. I saw a TPD cop race up to the car that had just driven into the Rito River, strip off her clothes and dive into the Rito River, which was in flood stage. I mean, that's,
right.
it wasn't Sandy. It was yeah. in the flood stage and save a person's life.
Yeah.
You know, cops are... They go out of their way to assist people,
yeah.
but the venom that they get from a very right. small segment right. of our society is astounding to me. You know, New York City police gets beaten up all the time by the so-called progressive politicians. But the realities are the New York City Police Department has, well, for example, at one point in time, there were 2,300 homicides per year in the city of New York, 2,300 homicides in New York City. By some aggressive engagement with community policing, they dropped it to 3,000 homicides. That means that 2,000 people did not die of homicide.
Right.
And the people that did not die of homicide were primarily from impoverished communities, which would mean they would be primarily, in our country, people of color because right. of 400 years of systemic racism, denying yeah. people opportunity. But the cops get blamed because they arrest a disproportionate number of people who come from an already underserved population.
Right.
But the cops, 77% of the people in Harlem said the New York City Police Department is increasing the quality of my children's life and my safety.
Yeah.
But that's not who has the microphone. That's yeah. not what the hijacked politicians will
Well, what I love, too, is that that group of people, regardless of what agency, continue to rise to the occasion, but the expectation from people that have never done the job, it is increasingly critical, you know? And it's like, well, these are just human beings who made this decision to do this job, but... you know, I think they had fractions of a second to make a decision, and you're taking months to sit here and second guess.
Cops
you know,
make good decisions, but it's not a level playing field.
Yeah,
it's driven by political ideology. It's not driven by our Constitution and our laws. Yeah. It's amazing to me to look at a cop get punished for things that they that were benign that they did. And looking at some officers, usually at an executive level, yeah. engage in absolutely inappropriate behavior, and nothing transpires. But, yeah. but the hijacked communities that have been hijacked by extreme anti-police political activists, those cities suffer tremendously. But who suffers the most are the poorest peoples and yeah. people in those communities, because yeah. that's where police services are most needed.
I always thought if you start from the foundation of doing the right things for the right reasons, you can't be fair weather and you can't change with the winds. You have to have that foundation. And then anything you do from there, regardless of whether it's in public favor or out of public favor, depending on what day of the week it is, you still cannot go wrong if you're doing the right things for the wrong reason or for the right, things for the right reasons.
I'm not going to be... I agree with you in theory, but I have seen police officers punished because they have done right. Mm. You mentioned a story where you did sternum rubs on somebody. I can remember a Pima County Sheriff's deputy being reprimanded for doing sternum rubs because they said he was being brutal. And he actually was trying to save the man's life that he just shot.
You know what's more brutal than sternum rubs? CPR.
Yes.
You want to break some break some ribs, you know?
You would assume that there'd be a benign executive reviewing it, making the correct decisions. But there's a lot of situations where the police officer doesn't have that benign executive. Yeah. And one of the things that happens is that it becomes disheartening. When you can have a profession where older cops are advising their kids to become firefighters, you have to look at that.
Right.
85% of firefighters in the United States, in one study, 85% of firefighters say they would do it again.
Yeah.
And they left their career saying it was a life well spent, they would do it again, and they have positive feelings towards their organization and their community. I go all over the United States, and I have police officers that are counting the date until they can retire and they can leave. And they're going to all move to some other state, and then then their life is going to become good. And you know, my goal is going and working with police, and why we wrote the book Emotional Survival was to have police have a quality of life today, not be looking at, well, in 13 years I'm getting the hell out of here, and it's KMA time, and I'm going to Idaho, and I'm going to fish every day. And our goal is to say, okay, what are you doing today? What are you doing today to make your life better, to be healthier, to have your family be happy? And that might sound Pollyanna-ish, but the cop who doesn't do that is the cop who's more likely to start suffering psychologically and physically. And that's the officer that makes the tactical error.
Right.
You know, when people ask me, what are the two most important things for police officers to be thinking about for their own well-being? Mm. And in today's world, everybody's talking about post-traumatic stress disorder and remedies for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm saying, well, PTSD is a very serious injury, but that by far the biggest injury to a police officer is sleep impairment. Mm-hmm. And the second is incremental weight gain. Those two things cumulatively over a 30-year lifespan will radically reduce the life expectancy of a police officer in the long run.
Yeah.
But in the short run, when a police officer is matched against a civilian in judgment and reaction time studies, the police officer tragically makes 600% more reaction time errors and judgment errors than does a matched civilian. Now, you transition this from the university laboratory to a dark alley at 3 a.m., and a judgment error is a suboptimal decision, is where a cop is yelling, taser, 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 then a live round goes off, and everybody wants to articulate why that happened. And nobody says, well, how much sleep have we been having our officers average? 4 to 6 hours is the average for America's police officers. That's what 83% of cops sleep.
Yeah.
Yet the vast majority of physicians will tell you 7 to 8 hours is required. Mm-hmm. So you have a cumulative life where you're cutting sleep short by 2 hours. And the first casualty of that is reaction time and judgment. And then we put our police officers into terribly dangerous situations, and we're doing very little to support them or even have sleep hygiene as training for the officers and they're in service.
Well, you sent me that text and you talked about lack of sleep and incremental gain, weight gain and diabetes and all this stuff.
Yes.
You know, and I was just like, don't be pointing that mirror at me.
Well, you know,
jerk.
No. You know, one of the things that I can remember doing in Tucson way back, you weren't born yet. We're talking the early 70s. Tucson, Arizona in the early 70s was one of the pioneers for the use of behavioral sciences in law enforcement. A very progressive chief of police, William Gilkison, a TPD at the time, hired Dr. Harold Russell. I think he was the second full-time police psychologist in the nation. And he started a legacy of having peer support, of having psych services, 20 years before that became the norm. Right. And I was just a young kid at the time and sort of fell under his mentorship. And one of the things we did was we had a lot of psych testing and we got to know a lot of cops. And as I look back on my years in this field, I've been able to track a generation of police officers for 50 years, the same group of Tucson police officers and Pima County deputy sheriffs for 50 years. And we still have reunions. And we'll have our next reunion next March.
Oh, wow.
And we'll get a couple of hundred cops there. And what troubles me is to see police officers become ill as they get older for diseases that are directly related to policing that with a little bit of training could have been prevented.
Yeah.
And it troubles me to see a police officer take their life when with a little bit of intervention, it could have been prevented. And having one age cohort that you started studying when they were 20, and now they're in their 70s and their 80s, and having seen them over all these years, it kind of personalizes it to me.
Right.
So it motivates me also to start looking back at how do we help young cops through this journey of their career? How do we turn back the tide on things that will shorten their life?
Right.
I just did a class this past week, a bunch of sergeants in the Northwest, and probably a third of the class had been diagnosed as type 2 diabetic. Mm-hmm. And these are guys in their late 40s, early 50s. And at that point, they have a 35% reduction of life expectancy. And we don't, that's directly related to policing, and we can prevent it. But we don't. And so when I'm looking at policing and the tragedies that cops have to see, I think we have to help them in this journey far better than we are.
Yeah.
We've gotten pretty good at policing with reactive assistance. If you're in a shooting, you're in a very traumatic event, there is a behavioral science component that will respond and will help you deal with the aftermath of those events. That's wonderful. It never used to be like that. But now we're very good with the reactive component. But we're still not good with the proactive component. We're still not looking at why are we shortening these cops' lives? And why? What can we do to keep a cop as fit 10 years after the academy as we graduated them from the academy?
Yeah.
There's a 50% reduction in physical exercise.
Oh, I believe
in police officers. Yeah. And a 50% reduction in 10 years in spiritual worship community engagement. And when we bring cops in and we bring their support systems, their partners and spouses in, we can do a lot better. And departments are starting to move into the wellness area, but we have to make it a priority like some other countries have, and we're still languishing behind.
So we got way ahead of ourselves, but we were talking about how you picked law enforcement and you said that it was in your family.
Sure.
And then you ultimately ended up getting hired by the Pima County Sheriff's Department.
Well, no. I was working for the Department of Justice on a law enforcement assistance administration project and was doing assessments on violent offenders. That's what my job was at that time.
Oh, wow.
Then the Pima County Sheriff's Department had, in this era, had a long history of corruption.
Oh.
They had indicted the sheriff. I think 19 commanders were indicted. And in lieu of pursuing that criminally, if the sheriff at that time retired, that charges would be dropped. And that's what happened. And then the Board of Supervisors appointed an interim sheriff, and he kind of rebuilt the sheriff's department. And an election took place. This is, oh my gosh, what is this, 76 or something, right?
Okay. Yeah,
and you were 2 years old. An election took place, and Richard Boykin was elected sheriff.
Okay.
And he, for his chief deputy, he brought over Major Clarence Dupnik from the Tucson Police Department.
Okay.
And in my work, I knew Clarence Dupnik, and I knew him to be a very competent, very ethical, just a professional law enforcement officer. Mm. And he became the chief deputy of the Pima County Sheriff's Department. And I don't know.
Where did Boykin come from?
Boykin was a former highway patrolman, DPS officer.
Okay, okay.
So Dick Boykin and Clarence Dupnik took over the sheriff's office. I didn't know Boykin. I knew Dupnik very well. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to start a behavioral sciences unit because that was his legacy at TPD. They had them there. So I respected Dupnik. I said, sure, okay, I came over, and I was recruited to go to to take that job. But I made it, I had a stipulation. I said, I would only do this job if the job was a commission job. And I went to the police academy and I became a deputy and went through that whole process and did my work in that capacity.
Okay.
Otherwise I have a better job with the Department of Justice than you're offering me.
Yeah.
And they agreed. So I came and, you know, went to the academy and wow. did that stuff. And I thoroughly enjoyed that level of responding to calls on the street and doing, and I was able to merge the, behavioral science aspect with application, you know, applied law enforcement.
Right. And, right. It's one thing to know the theory. It's another thing when you can see it in direct application. Yeah,
yeah. And I went into that job, and I never became a very good, experienced street police officer ever. But yeah. one thing I learned is the tremendous amount of respect that I personally gained for the men and women who are good, competent street police officers. Yeah. And I'm not sure a lot of the people that get into the executive level of policing actually hold that tremendous respect for the applied street police officer. Yeah. Because they, for many chiefs, that's just a stop along their ladder of promotion. And they, as they go up this accelerated ladder to become sergeants and lieutenants and captains and commanders and chiefs, that's good. We need those executives.
Right.
But it's the rank and file cop on the street that actually, in fact, determines policing. And,
yeah.
And so, you know, you're asking me, you know, my personal background.
Yeah.
It was much more the respect that I learned for that good deputy sheriff. And I would sit back and I would look at them deal with crises at 3 a.m. in the morning and yeah. watch them defuse situations. And my respect for that profession just grew tremendously. And then I said, you know, I personally would rather be trying to assist these men and women
right.
because they have a tough row to hoe. And how do we get services for them?
Yeah.
And that's, you know.
So how long did you patrol, and then did you transition away from that?
Oh, it was shortly. And then was into the behavioral sciences, you know, where 99% of my life was. Right. But it was always being called out on the hostage negotiation team or being involved in criminal profiling. But, you know, people say, well, you retired from a policing career. And I always want to correct that and say, I don't want you to envision me as the guy who's doing midnights for 12 years in a row, because that's not an accurate perception.
Yeah.
But, you know, 20 years of being called out in the middle of the night is an accurate perception. And I don't know if you had all those calls linked together, what it would amount to. But one of the things that I learned and to respect tremendously was how cops are tasked with solving unsolvable problems. And right now, the unsolvable problems that cops are thrown at is overwhelming. I spent last week with the Portland, Oregon Police Bureau, a wonderful, beautiful city, one of the most beautiful cities in the country 15, 20 years ago. Spotless, no graffiti. It was called the city that works. And then it got hijacked by so-called progressive politicians. They were just lunatics and hating the police, slashing the police, defunding the police, to now and make decriminalizing almost every drug that can exist.
Right.
Now when you walk down the streets of Portland, Oregon, you see nothing but passed out, drug-addicted folks, fentanyl addicts everywhere. Cops are just putting Narcan into people. And everyone blames the police because they don't solve the problem. Yeah. I look at the homelessness in Tucson, which is pretty minimal, actually, compared to
cities. I guess because to me, it looks like it's blown out compared to what it used to be.
But. Oh, it is getting blown out compared to what it used to be.
Yeah.
But take a run over to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Pop into Seattle and the Chop Zone. Go look at Portland, and you'll think, wow.
All of those are places I don't ever want to visit.
Well, those
for a lot of the same reasons you're describing.
But you know, tragically, those are all places that I loved to visit before things became insane. But the problem is everybody in society takes a step back and self-righteously blames the police. What are the police doing to deal with the mentally ill homeless? Yeah. Well, they're doing more than anybody else is, but the law ties their hands.
Yeah.
You have defunded state hospitals for 30 years. You've changed the commitment statutes, so a cop has to deal with the mentally ill, and there's no resources for that man or woman to deal with the mentally ill.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many hours I've spent with officers trying to get somebody committed to what was called
services.
Penal hospital at that time, only to have the person rejected and have the person go out and
reoffend.
Well, I had a person at the old Keno Hospital that we brought in because the cops thought they were a danger to their spouse, and we took her to Keno with her for several hours. Within about an hour after they cut her loose, she killed her husband, and she did exactly what the cops said she would do. But the cops get blamed for it.
Well, a nutshell example that I always use when I'm talking to people about. You know, even when I started on the police department, when I left the sheriff's department, went to the city, I think the sheriff's department had in the mid 400s, the city had like 1200. It was insane. And then when I retired, we had 760. And I just remember at some point there towards the end of my career, this church gets burglarized and all of their flat screen TVs and their stereo equipment, their speakers, all that stuff gets taken. They call 911. Nobody comes. Finally, like a day or two later, they get a phone call back saying, hey, I want to take your burglary report. Well, they're infuriated. You know, they're frustrated. They're mad because no one came to save the day.
As they should be.
Right. So they call the media. The media comes down and it's a big story on the news. And I just remember thinking to myself, if I'm that investigative reporter, because what did she do? She talked to the victim. She talked to the chief. Well, chief, what can you tell us? Why does it take 2 days for somebody to give a call back and not actually show up? And what's a chief going to say? Any chief, regardless of whatever, they're going to say, you know, we're really dealing with some significant challenges, but we're working to find a solution so that the public gets the police service that they deserve, which is a political answer and is BS. And I kept thinking to myself that whole time, hey, investigative reporter, go to City Hall. Go ask the mayor and the city council why 760 is good enough for a population of over a million people. Don't ask the chief. He could be fired tomorrow if he doesn't give you that answer.
The chief in most police departments is a political hack.
Unless
they're appointed there by the city council.
Yes.
And as soon as they don't do the city council's bidding, they're gone.
Right.
And you know, it's a little easier with sheriff's department.
Yeah, when you're elected, you know you at least have a term.
Yes.
You know, and unless you're a criminal miscreant, you're going to stay for your term.
Well, you know, I like states that, for example, sheriffs are elected, but they're not elected by affiliation to a political party. Here in Arizona, where we're doing this podcast, the sheriffs align with a political party. And if a city is predominantly one party or the other, that sheriff will be elected, whether yes. he or she is competent or not, or ethical or not.
Right.
I was with the sheriffs 2 days ago in the state of Oregon. They're non-politically aligned, mm-hmm. and they are elected based on their competency and their portfolio they bring forward for law enforcement expertise. Ah. A much higher caliber of sheriff gets elected there than political activists that get elected in Arizona. And yeah.
It's unfortunate. I talked to Mark Napier, I told you. And when he came over, I didn't really want to talk to Mark Napier, the former elected sheriff. I just wanted to talk to the cop so he could tell me about his career. But that was a gentleman who, when he was running, I'm like, absolutely. I don't know if he'll be able to get past the hump of D versus R, but he's definitely, I think, a dude that should be. And he got elected. He just didn't get reelected.
Well, I'm not
because we're in a microwave age and people's memories are very short.
Well, I'm not active in political entities at all, but I don't ever remember in my lifetime a Republican getting elected sheriff in Pima County. He might be the first in history, but and people vote party, but which is one of the sad things about sheriff's elections. But you know, when you were mentioning a moment ago, you gave reference to investigative reporter following up on the call why the police did not respond. Yeah. One of the biggest drawbacks that we as Americans are facing is the fact that we have lost local journalism. Print media has disappeared. It doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
In our town of Tucson, there used to be two thriving newspapers, the Arizona Daily Star and the Tucson Citizen.
Yeah.
And they would compete for in-depth stories about policing. Each had a full-time reporter assigned for the law enforcement beat. Mm-hmm. And the public was informed of what was happening at their police department, at their sheriff's department. Yeah. In explicit detail, they knew what was taking place.
Yeah.
Well, as American consumers of news, we have shifted from looking at local news and we have shifted to our attentions to national political news. Mm-hmm. So we no longer read the Arizona Daily Star or the Tucson Citizen, which is no longer exists.
Yeah, Citizen doesn't even exist.
No, yeah, after 100 years plus, it doesn't exist anymore. Now people spend countless hours watching MSNBC or Fox News, and we're listening to the Sean Hannity's or we're listening to Rachel Maddow's, and we're becoming consumers of information that we can do nothing about. But at the local level, we can address a school board meeting. We can address a sheriff's election. We may be, like the old saying goes, need to think globally, but act locally. Mm-hmm. And local, I can't even tell you who's on the local school board, but everybody will rant about books being banned in Virginia, which has nothing to do with their world here in Arizona.
Right.
But we elect people that we have very little knowledge of based on party affiliation.
Yeah.
And then you have a city like Tucson, which any law enforcement professional would say needs a minimum of 1,200 officers to 1,400 officers to adequately police the streets, has, 700 plus officers?
Maybe. Yeah.
And how many of those are actually in some form of an operational capacity?
Right.
And the rest are not doing widget jobs and just running around doing window dressing. But but that's, Tucson is just no different than other cities, and our country suffers from this. We have this defund the police. Well, when you defund the police, you are punishing people of color, because of all these years we talked about earlier, centuries of systemic racism. People of color have been denied opportunity. They've been denied housing. They've been denied education. They've been denied employment, and they're trapped into many times pockets of economic hopelessness.
Yeah.
Now, that's where gang activity thrives. That's where drugs thrive. That's where violence takes place.
Right.
And who has to deal with that are the police. Yeah. Everyone else is so kind of self-righteous. You see real estate developers developing tracts of land in beautiful communities.
Yeah.
You don't see the rebuilding of cities internally many times. And what ends up happening in that regard, when you defund the police, you escalate the violence in inner cities, and people of color are in fact paying the price for that. Yeah. I get troubled here in the 21st century of 2023 that we don't learn from history. There was a time American cities were at an all-time high of crime, quality of life had deteriorated, and a community policing revolution took place in the 90s, the mid-1990s. Bill Clinton had funded 100,000 new local cops. 100,000 cops additionally were put on the streets of America, and crime reduced to record lows, 35-year lows in just about every capacity of crime. Each city was funded with creative programs in community policing. Regional institutes of community policing were formed, and each city did it based on what their particular needs were.
Right.
Boston did it, and they went 2 years without a youth homicide. 2 years, whereas kids had been shooting themselves on a frequent and being shot and gang activity. 2 years without the death of a young person in the city of Boston because of creative strategies. They called it unlikely alliances in Boston at the time. Then 9/11 takes place. The planes go into the towers. Tragedy befalls our country. And immediately, this inner cities get forgotten, and local policing gets forgotten. All the funding that was being dumped into community policing gets transitioned into anti-terrorism task forces, which needed to be done, but our cities were forgotten. And now we fast forward to 2023, and we have elevated crime across our country. Response times are increasing. Crime is increasing. Yeah. You mentioned the case of the church in Tucson that was burglarized. Well, what I'm thinking of is the person who called the Tucson Police Department because people were breaking into his home. And if I'm not mistaken, it was reported it was a four-hour response time, and they found the man beaten to death. And that type of a tragedy should not be permitted in an American city. That chief of police should have been removed immediately. But we don't think in those terms when we think in political terms and not in professional terms. There's an old adage, an old saying that comes from Sir Robert Peel with Peel and Reform, and Robert Kennedy as the Attorney General used it. It's a great quote. It's, every city has the police department that it deserves. If you invest in your police department, if you sort of provide what your police department needs, you will have a police department that will serve your community. If you berate the police department, defund the police department, you'll have the police department that you deserve.
Yeah.
And I'm driving to the Tucson airport a few weeks ago. I'm on, I don't know if that's Kino Boulevard, heading south.
Yeah, it's Campbell to Kino to Campbell to Kino again, but
I'm at a major intersection. You know, three lanes going each way on intersecting, and I'm stopped at a red light. There's a Tucson Police Department officer right in the lane next to us. The light turns green. We can proceed. But I drive cautiously. I look to the right, and here comes a speeder. Blows the cold red. Ooh. Blows right through it at about 60. I think it's posted 45.
Yeah.
Blows right through the intersection. Continues. He's going from west to east. I'm going from north to south. And I proceed. The Tucson police officer next to me proceeds parallel to me in the opposite direction from the speeder who just blew the red light. My wife looks at me and she says, "How did that officer not see that?" I said, "Honey, he saw it just as well as you saw it." "Well, why isn't he chasing that guy?" I said, "Why should he? Why should he make that traffic stop? When he makes that traffic stop, he's going to be accused of being every aberrant conduct. He's going to be a racist. He's going to be a sexist. He's going to be a misogynist. He's going to be a colonizer. He's going to be a defender of the patriarchy." And he's going to be every in vogue accusation against police. And my wife said, well, what if that person hits somebody? Well, then there'll be a call for services, and he will dispatch, and he will handle the accident. Yeah. You have to understand, honey, I'm speaking to my wife, that today's police officers are so battered and so beaten up that they have to say to themselves, "You never get in trouble for the traffic stop you didn't make." I'll handle my calls, and that's all I'm doing, yeah. and I ain't doing a damn thing beyond that. And when you have a city or a country that has police officers that think that way, you're lost.
Yeah.
You're absolutely lost.
Yeah.
And those are officers we call emotional victims of the job. Mm-hmm. And that's why we call our training emotional survivors. We want them to be survive this job
right.
and thrive and know, I'll make this traffic stop, and I will do it ethically. I will do it safely. I will do it with integrity.
Right.
I'll have my body cam on, and they will document what I'm doing so that people will know I didn't say that. I didn't do those things.
Yeah.
But in order to have a police department do that, you have to invest in your police department. And you can't have a city like they have in Tucson where they've gone from 1,100 police officers to, what, 700 or 800
yeah.
and think you're doing a good job. That's a political disaster.
As a trainer that. And then as a supervisor and then also as a commander, I used to tell my baby cops, and they were babies to me. Sometimes they were even older than I was, but they were new in their profession, the way they handled and conducted themselves in work. They were baby cops. But I used to tell them, you know, as I was coming up and the way that I was taught coming from the sheriff's department over to the city is that I will take 911 calls for service because that is a necessary evil. And it's what I do between the times when I'm doing police work. And that's when I was proactively hunting, searching, trying to catch a bad guy before he had an opportunity to victimize, offend, sell drugs, whatever it is that he's doing. And I figure, you know, if I can get that dude and put him in jail, that's probably about 10 to 12 calls less that me and my buddies are going to have to take if I can go put him in the jail. And that's just how I always conducted myself and then tried to conduct anybody that was, I was, you know, responsible for.
That's called professional policing. But if you're in many cities in this country, taking the person to jail is an absolute waste of your time because
yeah.
they will be out of jail with no bond on a yeah. cash-free bond within minutes
yeah.
to reoffend.
Oh,
if
yeah.
you're in a state like California and where burglary or car smashes are just cited
yeah.
up to what, $950? So somebody is a pretty good shopper. They can go shoplift up to that amount and they know they're not going to jail. They
yeah.
give a false ID and they're out 10 minutes later. That's so disheartening for police.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
what my work is not to change the statutes of California. I have no authority capacity to do that.
Right.
I have no control over that. But helping that cop know, how do I go into this environment every day and still come home and coach my son's soccer team?
Right.
How do I go to do this job in Tucson and then get off duty and do CrossFit every day and then do things with my family, go bike riding with my spouse?
Mm-hmm.
Because looking at cops for the decades that I have, you know, 50 plus years of working with cops, I want that cop to live a long, rich, full, happy life. And that doesn't happen when you're world is controlled by people like the mayor's office or the board of supervisors who have an anti-police bend to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this circles back to the comment of cops telling their kids not to become cops. That's so sad.
Yeah.
That's so sad. And when we're looking at these issues, cities suffer, but our cops suffer also.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when I was newly promoted to lieutenant, we were in the 950s, and there was a discussion that was had that because I understand it, I completely understand it, fire and police, public safety takes up a lot of resources as far as their retirements, their benefits, and all that stuff. And there was a conversation had that 950 was too much. They could afford 850. And I always used to tell people, I was like, that doesn't mean that's safer for the community. That doesn't mean it's even safer for police officers amongst themselves. It just means that that's what they can afford. So they got to the 850, but the 850 who stayed were getting overworked. And overtime is only an incentive for so long. And then it's not even an incentive. And those people start to go away to other places where they think that they'll be appreciated.
Well, those decisions that you're recounting of
yeah.
people saying they can only afford 950, then they can only afford 850, those decisions are being made in vacuums in the dark that the people of Tucson, for example, they don't know those decisions are being made. If we had good local journalism, the public would be informed and they'd be outraged.
Right.
And they would say, well, wait a second.
Yeah.
We're having we're having this festival that the taxpayers are funding. Maybe we should not have the festival funded. Maybe we need to have 10 more cops on the street protecting people. And when you don't have an informed public, see, democracy is based on free press. And a democracy only exists with an informed public. And when all of a sudden you start having the free press disappear, as print media has disappeared because it's not cost effective in a digital era. But at the same time, when we start having censorship, when we start having information not being given out, well, then who holds the executive's feet to the fire? Who holds the city of Tucson's mayor's feet to the fire for the size of the Tucson Police Department?
Right.
You know who does that? Nobody does that. I mentioned to you earlier, during my career, I testified on the behalf of four Tucson police officers who had reported corruption by an executive at the Tucson Police Department.
Thank you for not using names.
Okay. I don't hesitate to use their name.
Yeah,
trust me.
Yeah, it's all public record.
yes, it is public record. Yeah. And I just, this was the question that I responded to. Would you want a police officer to report corruption of a supervisor and do that appropriately through the chain of command? And I said, well, that's a no-brainer. Of course you would. You want police officers to be based on integrity, not based on loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I testified to. And the chief of the Tucson Police Department at that point put me in his sights, would call and demean me to other law enforcement agencies that were using me as a psychologist. My contract with the Tucson Police Department was voided. The next bidding process for psychological services ended up being rigged. And so I sued them because I don't mind losing on a level playing field, but I don't like it when command officers are given an order to rig a bid. This happened at the city of Tucson. I sued them. The jury awarded me $2.9 million. That's a lot of money, $2.9 million.
Yes, it is.
And you would think a city manager, you would think a mayor, you would think somebody would be say, well, whoa, why are we having to pay $2.9 million to this idiot over here?
Yeah, when somebody puts you at that much risk.
After a six-week trial in federal court, the Tucson Police Department wrote the check. The city of Tucson, well, we settled for a little, just right at two. Okay, so... And I'm looking at that thinking, how did that level of systemic corruption take place at the executive level? And why wasn't anybody held accountable?
Right.
And I was so pleased when certain commanders from the Tucson Police Department came in and told the truth in court and said, yes, I was present when the order to rig the bid was given. Okay. And why was there no investigation? Well, because there was virtually no media coverage of it. You can write a check for $2 million to some Joe Blow in the community. Yeah. So when I look at Tucson, I'm very happy. I love baseball being very good to me, you know, because I own a lovely home on the Deschutes River in Oregon that the city of Tucson paid for. I have a very nice offshore salmon fishing boat that the city of Tucson paid for. I have a wonderful hide drift boat that I row down the rivers of Oregon salmon fishing that the city of Tucson paid for.
Yeah.
But now you tell me they can't afford 950 police officers, but they can afford to pay off corruption for something that never should have taken place. And that level of animosity exists to this day because I was going to do a simple little job of teaching an in-service training class for a class in Tucson, and the elected sheriff is notifying police officers to not go to that class and ordered their subordinates to not attend the training. And I'm laughing, thinking, well, some things die hard. They really do.
Well, you know, when you talk about doing little things for your health and that, when I was working in internal affairs, I was not doing great. Like I remember sitting there one day working and I felt like I was hanging upside down on monkey bars. Like I could feel the pressure in my head. And it was right at an election time. And I was like, what can I take out of my life so that I don't so I can reduce my stress. And I stopped watching the news. And I have not gone back to it. And that was in probably 2012. And so, but I remember being extremely frustrated as a police officer. And I talk about it in my book where it's just the rush to be first, not to be accurate and not to provide true facts. When you're talking about the media, to be first. Sure. And then if they are wrong, which many, many times, especially working in internal affairs, when you have intimate detail about a situation and they just run a story that is just completely, it maybe you only have one thing that's correct and everything else is just absolutely wrong. Being so frustrated with that. And then when they get called on it or when they're corrected, not printing a correction or going on the air and saying, hey, you know what? We were wrong about this. Here are the facts. Like that just doesn't happen. And so I don't have any room. There's no more room in here for that.
Yeah,
you know,
I
don't need it.
It's the news has become entertainment, but what I look at is when you described the feeling of, you know, the headache and those things. If I ask police officers, what's the most important skill set for them to master? They'll say what they think the politically correct answer is, you know, diffusing conflict and sensitivity to cultural individual. Those are all important things, obviously.
Right.
But the most important skill set is officer safety. Every cop that goes to work has to come home at night to their loved ones. That is the most important aspect of policing. And we teach street survival very, very effectively in the United States. But when you teach somebody street survival, you have taught them something that is going to cause them to become type 2 diabetic, that's going to cost them incremental weight gain. And we need to link street survival with emotional survival. Just quickly, when you're looking at a situation, you have elevated alertness as a police officer.
Oh, yeah.
So what you're doing is you're elevating your adrenal cortical response of your sympathetic autonomic nervous system. So what happens is cortisol hits your liver releases blood glucose. That's the energy cops feel. That's the enthusiasm. That's why cops like being cops. But your pancreas kicks out insulin. That grabs a proportion of that blood glucose, and it starts storing that blood glucose in the fat cells around the abdominal area. It says, we don't know how long this threat is going to exist. Hold back some of your fuel in case the threat goes on for long periods of time. Like a cop going out on the street taking extra magazines. They don't know how long the threat will exist. Mm-hmm. So by practicing officer safety and not telling the cops about that glucose metabolism effect of high alertness, you have to be alert every day at work, the cop's waist size will increase.
Yeah.
Now, incrementally, you have a cop do this over 15 years. That 175-pound physically fit cop that's running every day is now 210 pounds. Mm-hmm. And the size 34 Wranglers are now 38 Wranglers. Then in a few years, they're relaxed fit Wranglers.
Oh, yeah.
And we have never linked that for the officer to know. So now the officer is 48, 49. And blood glucose levels are elevated, and we put the cop on metformin, and the cop now has a 400% greater likelihood of death by stroke or heart disease. And all totally avoidable, all because the cop is doing a good job. And when I speak to cops, and I'll say, let me ask you, you're a cop 10 years. Yeah. Can you fit in the uniform you graduated from the academy in? And they'll think I'm laughing with joking. Mm. And I'll say, well, that's indicative of the physiological effects of practicing officer safety. And everything we want to do is talk about the psychological effects. And I'm asking them to look at the psychophysiological effects.
Right.
We can't do anything about the news. We can't do anything about the politicians.
Right.
If we had local media, maybe we could voice and things like police associations can stand up and voice opinions. But I look around the country and I look at police unions fighting trivial things. And we're not looking at major events that will affect the lives of the brother and sister officers. And our cops die prematurely. They die young.
Right.
And When I'm doing, and I speak to these officers and listen to them, I'm always amazed at how unenlightened they are, because we don't give them that information. They can make a high risk felony stop effectively. That's they have to.
Right.
But then we have to know what's the effect of that on your health, on your children, on your life every day, and we have to be able to balance that and teach them strategies to intervene. And so, you know, when we talk about not listening to the news, I that's a good idea, because you can't do that. I remember Laura Bush, after 9/11, they asked her as the first lady, what suggestion do you have to help your children with everything that's going on with the World Trade Center? Mm-hmm. She said, stop watching the news. Go for a walk with your kids. Go play with your kids. Don't sit by the hour and just watch these terrible tragedies. And that's what's happened. Right. We sit for hours watching and listening to the news, but we're not hearing local news.
Yeah, especially with, you know, these electronic devices that we have now. You can be plugged in all the time and constantly stimulated by either positive or negative. Typically tends to be negative, because they understand the algorithm. It boosts involvement when it's negative.
And we're in an information age. I'm working on a project for the U.S. State Department, and I'm in Vilnius, Lithuania, working with the Baltic nations and emerging democracies, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and working with their police, getting them to think like democratic Western policing societies think. And I go back to my hotel room, and I turn on the television set, and there's Cops. And on Cops, this particular episode is the Tucson Police Department.
Yeah.
And I'm watching in Lithuania, the Tucson Police Department officers all, and it's funny because they're speaking to each other in Lithuanian because it's been dubbed in.
Right.
And I'm thinking, this is the world we live in today. An event occurs in Tucson, Arizona. Some cops are dealing with a funny call on the south side of Tucson, and people in Vilnius, Lithuania are being entertained by watching that, and it is transpiring. I am in Alice Springs, Northern Territory, Australia, with the Northern Territory Police. They asked me if I want to go for a ride that night with them, because they know I like to ride horses. So I go out, assume we're going on a horseback ride, and they present me with a camel to ride, because it was a joke. So
it's not every day you get to take your picture on a camel. So.
Yeah, well, I have a wonderful picture sitting on this camel with a couple of Aussie cops. But there's a South Korean cop there also.
Oh wow!
And doesn't speak a lick of English. I'm not real handy in Korean. Mm-hmm. And he picks up his Google Translate. He says something to me. He hands it to me. So he shows me how to speak in English on my phone.
Yeah.
I hand it back to him. And we're talking back and forth via Google. So when you're talking about avoiding information that doesn't add to the quality of your life by turning the news off and maybe, you know, going over your kids' homework, absolutely. And those are the little tips that we want our cops to have for survival. We know our cops are gaining weight incrementally. Mm-hmm. We want them to know where that goes down the line 20 years from right now, and we want to get them into the gym. And we want our cops to, we want our unions to be fighting for relevant issues.
Yeah.
The city of Tucson needs 1,300 cops.
Yeah.
In order to have a quality of life in this community. Or we can just deal with the nonsense. We deal with it and become another Portland, Oregon, and just
let it deteriorate. Was interesting, at the same time that they were saying about that 950 and 850, they had an independent organization come in and do a study. And this gentleman was from New York. And he went around the entire agency. He's like, tell me what you do. How many cases per year? How many cases per month? How many staff do you have? Blah, blah, blah. And he did a work study. And it took him a couple of months. And at one point, I was working in special investigations at the time as a brand new lieutenant. And we all had to go into this conference room. And he came in and he asked everybody, tell me about your group. Tell me what you do. Tell me about your group. Tell me what you do. How many people do you have? So on and so forth. And I remember this thought going through my mind, is that if that gentleman goes back, collates the numbers, and comes out with a report that says 850, we'll never hear the end of that. We'll never hear the end of that. If he comes back and generates a report with any number over 850, which he said 1,400, will never hear of that work study ever again. And so as a newer lieutenant, you know, the chief at the time would go around the agency and meet with people because he wants to hear what's going on, you know. And I asked him, I said, hey, whatever happened with that work study? He said 1,400. And the chief at the time says, every time I meet with them, I tell them about our decaying fleet. I tell them about our staffing, and I tell them about crime stats. And they tell me, thank you, chief, that's very nice. And then water department, you know, city streets, and it's like water off of a duck's back.
Well, when you don't have local media, that happens. When you don't have local newspapers that are thriving, the cornerstone of a democracy is a free press.
Yeah.
And as we have transitioned to just being entertained at night by Rachel Maddow or Sean Hannity, we lose what's
it's
happening.
It's definitely editorialism more than it is, here's the facts.
Yes.
You decide how you want to feel about it.
Absolutely. You decide where your tax dollars get spent. Yeah. If you want them spent on I always look at the University of Arizona as a great example. I noticed that there was a $250 million shortfall. Right? And yet I look around the university and I see program after program after program being funded that has nothing to do with educating the young students of the state of Arizona. Right.
To be productive members of society.
Has nothing to do with that. But we have all these ancillary.
Well, at the same time, there was an article, they were almost competing articles. Here they're talking about a $240 to $250 million shortfall. And over here they're talking about, our football coach did such an outstanding job, we have to give him a significant contract.
Well, I think we need to because he's a great football coach.
And I'm just like, ha ha, like from where?
If you're a CEO of a company and you just lost $250 million, you need to be on the unemployment line.
Yeah,
you know, you're like the guy who
but where do they get this money
did
for
the Bud Light commercials. You know, you need to go
where do they
away.
Get the significant contract for the coach if they already got a $240 million? Yeah, it's still coming from the same,
you have to have a fiduciary interest to look into it. When I look at the challenges to cops, all this chaos exists around them. All the societal chaos that they can't control.
Yeah.
They can't, but they can control the effect it's having on their life. When you put a really good police officer on the street. Now I'll take the average police department today hires really good people. We're doing psych testing, polygraphs, background investigations. We're hiring high quality young men and young women. We're putting them on the streets of America. And we're doing nothing to maintain them.
Yeah,
I was describing an aberrant experience I had with a cop back in the state of New Jersey in one of my seminars. And I was just describing this to a bunch of chiefs. And the chief said, we would never hire a guy like that at our department. We would never hire a guy like that. I said, chief, you don't hire idiots at your department? No, we don't hire idiots. I said, you're right. We don't hire idiots. We manufacture idiots because we hire good people and we don't maintain them and they just wear out. And after 10 or 12 years, we get conduct. Well, like that Tucson police officer who failed to make the left turn and knock off that motor vehicle and cite them or see whether they're impaired.
Right.
The first sign you're losing a police department is called an act of omission. Mm-hmm. They're not acts of commission. Right. It's not that they do wrong. Right. They just stop doing right. And when you go from department to department and you hear people say, I'll handle my calls and that's all I'll do. I'm not doing anything more.
Right.
You know you have lost that police department. And we both reside in the city of Tucson. And we've lost. It's a lost battle here. It needs a total renaissance to rethink.
Yeah.
And I look at this from a very different perspective. I live half my life in Tucson now and the other half in Oregon. And for 18 years, that half was in Portland. Mm-hmm. And Portland got so insane, I left. Yeah. And I was doing a podcast last week in Portland. And they said, well, what did you do with all – what suggestions do you have? I know how I handle the craziness of Portland. I said, I moved – to Bend, Oregon. And in Bend, Oregon, the police officers, people wave at them with all five fingers. They're respected. People thank them. People are very appreciative that in Bend, Oregon, the police officers are there to serve and protect them, and they do.
Yeah.
They had a mass shooting in one of their Safeways. The police officers ran in there and addressed that issue, mm-hmm. and the community thanked them, even though those, I think, three people or four people lost their lives.
Yeah.
But they thank them. I wonder what would happen in Tucson. We might get criticized. I don't know. I like to think the average Tucsonan thinks a great deal about cops.
Right.
But do they get their voices heard? And does that get without local media? No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You get talk shows on the radio is what you end up.
Well, and I had said this, you know, as a young cop and predominantly working shift work, I was never meeting people from the regular public. I was meeting people in crisis all the time. And typically one of those individuals was going to jail. So as a young cop, you get this crusty outer shell. You start to think the whole world's bad and there's only a few good apples and probably just the people in the uniform. And that continues for some period of time. And I think what helped me transition away from law enforcement and into the civilian world is at the end of my career, when I became a commander, you become more of a political animal than you are a police officer on the beat. And so what that allowed me to do, if there was any positive to that rank, was that I started meeting normal people again, the people that were buying my coffee, the people who were thanking me for my service. As I like to jokingly say, I was more kissing hands and shaking babies at the end of my career than I was taking people to jail. And so it allowed me to come full circle to where, because before I was a cop, I thought, oh, everybody's good with a few bad apples. And then it doesn't take long for you to complete, you know, flip-flop that. But then at the end of my career, it did help me see, okay, so not everybody's bad. There are some people in the community, even if they're not heard, that appreciate the police and what they're doing for them.
Well, they have to have the microphone. Yeah. And like I mentioned, the Manhattan Foundation found out that 77% of the people of Harlem, a predominantly African-American community, yeah. thought the New York City Police Department was doing a good job to protect their children yeah. and increase the quality of life. 77%. But that wouldn't be reported because yeah. the microphone was by people like Al Sharpton, who are anti-police.
And you made me think of this earlier, and then we got off on another topic. But a good buddy of mine, we've been friends since junior high, and he's a black gentleman. And we went through junior high, high school, and even a year of college together. And we've remained friends all these years. But whenever one of these major national incidents would pop up, you know, I'd get peppered with questions. And I'm never going to defend someone who does something wrong, because nobody hates a bad cop more than good cops. But what I told him, I said, you know, rather than listening to Fox or CNBC or MSNBC, what I recommend to you is to go to the police department closest to your house, fill out the waiver, and go on a ride. Because you need to hear, first of all, what kinds of things your cops in your community are doing for you. Secondly, you need to hear how that officer's talking to the public, and you need to see how the public is talking to that officer, and that will give you a really good idea. And he says, but how come more cops in the black neighborhood, not more cops over on the other side? I said, well, here's the deal. As a commander and as a sergeant, if you told me that crime is out of control here, and I had five cops, and I told you, yeah, but we don't want to over-police your neighborhood, so I'm just going to give you this one, and I'll send the other four over to the white neighborhood or the affluent neighborhood or whatever, I would be fired as an incompetent because I'm not addressing the issues. So what do I do? If I've got five, and you're telling me that crime is blowing up in this economically depressed area where people are trapped by their circumstances, probably three out of those five are going there. And I'm going to send my most hypervigilant and my most meat eater because I want to affect change as best as I can with the limited resources. And those other two, they'll kind of float amongst the other neighborhoods and maybe respond to some other outlying issues. But these three, the ones that I know are the best cops that I got, they're going here. And so will the numbers of people of color arrested, will that go up? Absolutely. You know, will other things that, you know, in that area go up? Will you see more of them? Absolutely.
But the number of people of color that are victims of homicide will go down. And
yeah.
And when you want to know what's going on in minority communities,
yeah.
ask the inner city ministers. Not the so-called ministers that are on the national news as Reverend such and such. No, ask the people that have a congregation who are actually going up to the home and telling that family that they've just lost their son to a shooting. Right. They just lost their daughter to a drive-by or gang activity. Those men and women, those ministers, they want more cops. They don't want less cops in their community.
And you would be fired. You would be fired as incompetent if you couldn't just look at sheer just numbers and take the emotion out of it. Take the people of color out of it. Just look at the numbers alone. And if you have a high crime area, then as a leader amongst law enforcement people, you would send the majority of your folks into that area to knock down whatever those issues are to get it back to a position where it could start to now grow.
Well, as much as we talk about America being a colorblind society, we cannot take color and race out of our legacy because we have 400 years of systemic racism. Yeah. We have 400 years of people of color being denied every opportunity of the American dream. Tucson's no different. And the cops didn't cause that. Early in my career at Pima County, I was listening to a man speak, a civil rights activist in Tucson, Cressworth Landers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this gentleman is even still alive. He was an older gentleman years and years ago. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, do you think the police and the criminal justice system are inherently racist? And I totally expected the answer, yes.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I don't think it is.
Yeah.
He said, I think the criminal justice system is the end point of a racist society. Hmm. When the police arrest a young kid of color for a homicide, the kid committed the homicide and it has to be arrested.
Right.
He goes, but what were the background variables that caused that young kid to not have the opportunities, to put him into the poverty of that situation? Mm-hmm. That's where the racism exists. And when that occurs, we kids born in poverty don't have the same opportunities as a kid born in the foothills of Tucson. And I would like to see a kid from the absolute poorest section of Tucson have the exact same opportunities that the kid in the richest neighborhood has. Mm-hmm. But at this point they don't. But until that playing field gets leveled, our cops are going to be disproportionately dealing with aberrant conduct. Aberrant conduct grows out of poverty many times. And when we don't address poverty, we're at a loss. And when I look, the cops are left holding the bag, and everybody in the community blames the cops. Mm-hmm. They blame the cops for differentials in arrest rates between ethnicities.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the victims of crime. I was just reading a review by the medical examiner's office out of Cook County, Illinois. Uh-huh. They did the first 1,000 homicides last year. The first 1,000 homicides where the cause of death was homicide, and the medical examiners clicked off ethnicity. 94% of those homicide victims were people of color. 94% in a community that's about 50% people of color.
Right.
94% of the homicide victims were and we talk about arrest rates. Well, let's talk about victimization rates.
Right.
And the victimization rate in the United States for being a homicide victim some years is 400% higher for a young black man. Mm-hmm. And until we address those factors so that a young child of color has the exact same opportunities that an affluent Caucasian child has, then police will be left dealing with the differentials. The cops, I see cops in the country that take less enforcement in communities because they don't want to be accused of being a racist. And we undervalue victims of color. Hmm. Years and years and years ago, there was an event happened in Tucson that was 30 years ago. Gary Triano was blown up at a resort up here in the foothills. There were 40 FBI agents and police officers assigned to his death, and he was blown up. A young kid on the south side was killed in a drive-by shooting the same week. And the homicide unit, I can't even remember now whether it was the sheriff's department or the police department, responded. And they did an investigation.
Right.
Five detectives probably each have 10 open cases,
right,
and they're working long hours for this one young kid of color get shot. And the factors that led to that one young brown kid getting killed on the south side of Tucson, those are more related to the city of Tucson
right.
and addressing those issues than is Gary Triano getting blown up here at La Paloma, whatever resort he was blown up
right.
at. And I'm thinking, well, they both need to be investigated,
yeah.
but why does one warrant 40 cops and one get a group of overworked homicide detectives? And until you level that playing field,
yeah.
and until you hold the mayor's feet to the fire about that, and you're only going to do that through local media, mm-hmm. and you're not going to do that by, you know, Fox News or MSNBC. And that's where we circle back to where we started on this.
Yeah. And so let me ask you this. So how long did you spend with the Sheriff's Department then?
I spent about 20 years with okay. Pima County.
Yeah.
Then while I was in my job at Pima County, I was doing a lot of training.
Yeah.
Training for the Phoenix PD, for Arizona Department of Public Safety. Then I started training for over in California. Mm. And I was still on the job with the sheriff's office. I'd spend my weekends traveling places. My vacations with my family were spent working in Florida for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And my, you know, so we'd go down to Florida. We'd get a house on the beach. I'd right. teach cops. And my kids would go to Disney World and places. Right. And it worked well. Then for a period of time up in Marana, they had the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. Hmm. So they asked me if I'd teach a little bit. Then all of a sudden the doors opened and the federal agency started hiring me.
Nice.
Then I started teaching at the FBI Academy. Then I retired from the sheriff's office.
And when in that same kind of period of time, when did you write this?
Well, the book Emotional Survival yeah. for Law Enforcement. Well, that was a compilation of many, many years.
Yeah.
I had a guy when I was supervising the behavioral sciences unit. He said, "You need to write a book." Mm-hmm. And I said, "I don't want to write a damn book."
Right.
He goes, "You need to write a book." I said, "You know what? I'd much rather go team roping than I would write a book. So I ain't writing a damn book."
Right.
And he goes, "Well, you know what, Gil Martin? When you die, these ideas you have die also."
Yes.
I said, "Well, ain't you a cheerful soul?"
Which is why I do the podcast. Yeah,
and he says, "You don't think cemeteries are full of good ideas that dead people had that never got written down?" I said, "You know what? I never thought about that." So I wrote the book. And the first rendition of that book came out around 2000, 2001.
Okay.
It's in its ninth revision now, and it sold about 3 million copies. So the book
revised
been,
why?
Oh.
Just with new and updated information?
Well, the foundational information doesn't change very yeah. much because we base our information on, or our premise rather, on hypervigilance and the need for elevated alertness. That doesn't change.
Right.
Now, the medical technology that lets us measure that has changed, and that's added.
Okay.
But, you know, I was shocked when I read the first edition of this book mm-hmm. and how much of a baby boomer I am, because I read the book and I realized how come in this first edition of this book, all the cops are males and all the spouses are females. Mm-hmm. And I said, boy, that's pretty sexist. So we started the he-she issue.
Yeah.
Then we looked at it further, and some of the things that were germane to a cop in 1990, mm-hmm. this cop coming home exhausted, sitting down and watching television, that's outdated technology. I have cops today, some of them don't even own televisions. They walk around with their handheld digital device,
yeah.
and so they don't disengage by watching television. They disengage by spending hours mindlessly scrolling through social media.
Right.
And our cop is still gaining 20 pounds.
Yeah.
Our cop is still not playing catch with his or her child. And so we got more – technology affected us more than yeah. anything else, and the effect. But and then we added information on heart disease and diabetes mm-hmm. and – obviously needed to update the data on things like suicide rates and stuff like that.
Right.
So okay. the book, the latest rendition of this book came out about 6 months ago.
Oh, nice.
And then I, as we mentioned, I always joke with people, and I'll go into a conference of, maybe it might be 800 cops there in a seminar. And I'll say, "How many of you have read that book?" And I'm humbled and shocked when half the audience raises their hand.
Yeah.
And I'll say, well, you know, it's not a well-written book. And I'll say, I know it's not well-written because I wrote it. And I'm not a good writer. And I'm from Arizona where literacy is optional. And but what, you know, is I'm an old guy. And as I look back, I'm astounded at where the book has ended up.
Yeah.
And, you know, just about every cop in Australia gets a copy of that book.
That's cool.
Across Canada, cops get copies of that book. Mm-hmm. And about 50% of our states, it's basic issue at police academies,
yeah.
Except here in Arizona because of the legacy of that chief of the Tucson Police Department. But that's okay. I mean, Arizona's where I spend my winters. And
in 2014, I had the honor of being the basic training sergeant at Southern Arizona Law Enforcement Training Center. And for the officers who worked with me and around me who knew that I had written that book, they're like, you should make all the rookies get your book.
Yeah.
And I said, I would never do that while I am the basic training
sergeant.
Sure,
it's a conflict. Yeah.
Conflict of interest. However, when I step away and I go to do something else, I certainly would encourage them, you know, because you know, my experiences is your experience is their experience, and we all have been to something similar. Yeah. And I'm just telling my children how I felt about it.
Absolutely.
When I was there.
And yeah. And we have a better profession because of that, where some cop in Kansas can read your book mm-hmm. and hear about your experiences. There's a police officer in Calgary and Alberta, and I'm embarrassed because I like to plug his book and I'm not thinking of his name right now, but he wrote a book. He's written several books, but one of them was What You Know Now That You Wish You Knew Then. And it's just little tidbits of wisdom.
Yeah.
You can have education, you can have knowledge, but until you mix the knowledge with experience, you won't have wisdom. And while older cops have wisdom, younger cops thrive for that wisdom. And unless they hear the voices of the cops that came before them, they won't have that learning perspective. And the only perspective they'll get is what the politically sanitized, you know, people that set state police training curriculums up are. And I'll give a case in point. We touched on it earlier. Not incremental weight gain, but sleep deprivation.
Yeah. Oh, I got a machine in there.
83% of America's police have sleep impairment. 83%. Mm-hmm. And it increases the likelihood by 600% of a reaction time judgment error. Okay. That data is firm. Yet tell me where we have mandatory training on sleep hygiene by posts across the country. We don't.
Mm.
But what we will have is implicit bias training. Now, I'm not denying bias in the United States,
right?
But I'm asking what part of that bias is implicit. I can drive around cities across our country, and it's very explicit. That's a rich white neighborhood. That's an impoverished black neighborhood. That's not implicit bias to see the differences in how people act and react in those communities. Mm-hmm. So we have to have police officers that are bringing their A game to decision making. Yeah. We can't have sleep deprived, angry, incrementally weight gained officers coming in and trying to diffuse a conflict because they will not be able to do it.
Yeah.
We need to invest in our police officers the way we invest in professional athletes because they have to be in a performance mode when they step on the field, and we're not. So we have officers do absolutely aberrant behavior. And we wonder, why did that happen? Well, because we're not maintaining them and we're not actually giving them training in the behavioral issues that will, in fact, affect their career. Now, you mentioned, you know, towards the end of your career, you realized that you knew lots and lots of bad guys and you knew cops. Well, yes, because police deal with society at its maddest, its baddest, and its, you know, most horrendous, except when you're off duty. But if you're not doing anything when you get off duty, now you're a 20-year veteran cop, and you can tell me the name of every gangster in town, and you can tell me the name of you know, every drug dealer, but you can't tell me what's playing at the community theater.
Mm-hmm.
And cops, I go nuts when I have cops tell me, they say, well, these guys don't live in the real world. I'll hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. I got 50 cops, 100 cops. They don't live in the real world. And I'll say, if there's anybody in the society that doesn't live in the real world, it's you cops. Because you're experts on drug trafficking, on human trafficking, on fatal car accidents. You're experts on aberrant human behavior at its maddest, its saddest, and its baddest. And you have to be.
Right.
But I want you to be an expert, and you can tell me what's playing at the community theater. Mm-hmm. I want you to be an expert on coaching soccer for your kids. I want you to be an expert at teaching Bible study at your house of worship. And until we have cops that can balance those two things,
right,
we destroy human beings. And that circles us back to kind of where we started the,
yeah,
the conversation.
Aside from this book, have you considered fiction, or if you wrote another book about your experience, have you thought about like what a title would be for that?
No, I have not, because you know, I'm kind of a one trick pony, and this book is my trick, and we add to it, we evolve it, mm-hmm, and the success that the book Emotional Survival has had is overwhelming to me, and I'm thinking, you know, you get only so many semesters on this planet before you get recycled, so you know, we work on the book, and the book seems to help cops, and you know, I'm always astounded by where that book has ended. And I'm not trying to sell books, but I'm fly fishing in a river in Oregon. And I'm an avid fly fisherman. And I'm out there fly fishing. It's about 9 p.m. Long, long days because of daylight savings. So I'm out there, it's about 9:15, 9:30. The sun's going down, and I can't see my dry fly floating around in the water anymore, so it's time to go home. So I climb out of the river. I'm walking down this trail. I have like a mile back to my pickup truck. And all of a sudden, another fisherman pops out of the bush, and he's walking next to me. And I said, "Well, you have any luck?" "Yeah, I picked up a couple of fish." And I notice he has that book in his backpack, in his fishing gear. I said, "Can I ask you a question? Sounds kind of odd." I said, "What the hell do you have that book with you for? Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement." Uh-huh. And he says, "Are you familiar with that book?" I said, "Yeah."
Not vaguely.
I said, I wrote that book. And he starts laughing. And he says, "Oh, yeah, you taught our in-service training." I said, "That doesn't answer my question."
"Yeah.
What the hell do you have that book for, fishing?" He goes, "Well, I really wasn't just fishing." He goes, "I run a trauma support program, mm-hmm, and we were downriver doing a program called Tight Blue Lines. And after a trauma, we teach police officers to fly fish, and we take them out here on the river, and we decompress with them, and we show them how to fly fish. And every so often, some guy just wants to get out of the river and wait for a half hour to warm up a little bit because the water is very cold."
"Yeah."
"And we have some books for them to read. And one of them is your book." I said, "Do you know what? I caught a couple of fish tonight, but it wasn't my best day of fishing." "Uh-huh." "But you just made it my best day of fishing."
"Nice."
"Because you're a cop helping other cops."
"Yeah."
"And that's what counts. And if my little book helps you do that, then I can lay my head to rest at night and feel it's been a good day." But you know, but I have no interest in writing another book. I'll continue to teach in service training.
Yeah.
And we have four other younger instructors that are out beating the bushes, and mm-hmm, I'll go to the places. When I get called by a police department to teach in service training, I look at where that agency is, mm-hmm, and I Google what the fishing around the area is. And if there's good fishing in the area, I go there. And if there's not, I send one of the other instructors
that
to go there.
Sounds like a pretty good place to be in life.
Well, when you get to be old, you get to have those options. But that's 50 years of work to get to that.
Well, let me ask you this, because one of the things, and we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, one of the things that I've embraced about this podcast is I honestly felt like I was just going to have cool people over to tell cool stories. And what I found is a lot of my friends and a lot of people I've gotten to meet as a result of doing the podcast have come on here and been pretty vulnerable and pretty open about the therapies and the different organizations that they're a part of that have helped them with PTSD and the other things, the lingering things that come from a lifetime of law enforcement. So much so that it actually prompted me, and I told you this when we were texting back and forth, to apply to the Boulder Crest Foundation. And I went to their camp for a week. It was in February, and they do a lot of the same things like what you're describing with the fly fishing. It's like, look, we're not therapists. We're not taking notes. We're not doing a diagnosis, but what we're doing is giving you, it was like 20 some odd practices that you can use to decompress, equine therapy, weightlifting, meditation, all these different things, music, art,
yes,
you know,
yes,
cooking, just different things that you can do that are not affiliated with your day-to-day life to help you decompress and to deal. And I didn't anticipate that to come out of the podcast, but once it started happening, then I started encouraging it. I'm like, yes, please talk about it. Where can people find it? Because in my mind, what I think of is that someone somewhere, wherever, is going to listen, and maybe they're struggling and they don't know that there's either no cost or low cost something right now that they can call and they can get some help. And so it was definitely something that I've embraced. And so when I had an opportunity to reach out to you and have you on, then it continues that path of, yeah, let's hang out and let's talk about our careers and tell some cool stories. But also if there's something else that you've got in your little fanny pack that you can throw out there.
You know, when people look at their careers and they look at traumas and they look at things like that, and I've been to fatal car accidents and homicide scenes and all those things like anybody else in law enforcement has. Yeah. But I've always had the capacity to clinically detach from that. And I got to say, I've never been traumatized by those. But what traumatizes me is when a cop kills himself.
Yeah.
You know, I mourn that. I take a step back and I say to myself, what could you have done to prevent that? And these are not even cops that I've had it in my counseling or patients, but I'm saying, well, why did that Pima County deputy sheriff kill himself? Why did that Tucson police officer take their life? What was it that backed them into the corner that they did not see the warning signs? And that redoubles my efforts to go back and rethink the lesson plan. And if I didn't have a passion for trying to prevent that, I wouldn't teach in-service training for cops again. I would just, because thanks to the Tucson Police Department and them paying me $2.39 million, I don't have to work, you know, and I can enjoy life very comfortably.
Yeah.
And my grandkids will probably enjoy life very comfortably. Yeah. But it, you know, at the end of the day, you want to be able to feel like you've helped somebody or you've done something to assist people. And the foundation you went to is giving you good advice. And I've, for decades, I would study places like that.
Yeah.
And you know, I would tell you, if you asked me, I would say there's three things cops have to do.
Okay.
And three very simple things. What are the guides to emotional survival? 3 points.
Okay.
The first point is a cop has to keep a written personal calendar. You have to put that calendar on the refrigerator, and you have to pre-plan personal things that you are going to do. For example, on your Sunday or your Monday of any given week, you should have something down that you are going to do on your Friday. Because when Friday comes around, you'll be exhausted and you will not want to make a decision. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to make a decision. It was made on Monday. Mm-hmm. You know you're going to get off, and Friday you're going to go for a bike ride with your spouse at at Catalina State Park.
Yeah.
And because this one thing first responders lose, and that's because they're in elevated alertness all day long, they drop into a depression after work, and they don't want to make decisions.
Yeah.
So the calendar is front-loading the decisions. When a cop comes to see me in counseling, I always ask to look at their phone because I want to look at their calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, why do you want to look at the calendar, Dr. Gilmartin? Because I want to know how you're spending your life. And when I see a cop who's active in CrossFit 3 days a week, they're active in Bible study at their church, mm-hmm. they're going skiing, they ride their bikes getting ready for the Tour de Tucson, I don't worry so much about that cop because they have a life.
Yeah.
But when I look at a cop who has stopped doing things personally,
mm-hmm.
because they get off work exhausted and they just spend the day watching television or scanning social media. That cop concerns me. Yeah. So the first thing is keep a written calendar, discuss it with your family members, and post it in paper, hard copy, on the refrigerator so everybody in the family knows that's a contractual commitment to remain a member of that family. Uh-huh. I had an older LAPD cop come up to me, and he said, you know what, Gil Martin, my wife and my kids know they're the most important thing in my life. I would lay my life down for my family. They know that. They're the most important thing in my life. I'm just not good at showing them that they're the most important thing in my day. And I come home a lot of times all pissed off about some bullshit that the Los Angeles Police Department's pulling, and I piss away the day. The trouble is, if you do that enough, you've pissed away your life, because all your life is a bunch of days strung together. Hmm. I wish I had captured him on tape, because I've dealt with so many older cops who have pissed away their life because they come home every day, they disengage, mm-hmm. and they don't live vibrant personal lives, but they're good cops. Yeah. And they've failed marriages, failed relationships, and life has gotten away with them. So the first thing is a written calendar.
Yeah.
The second thing, we have to have cops understand officer safety requires elevated physiology, which leads to a depressive state after work. How you get out of that depressive state after work each day is by 150 minutes of moderate physical exercise a week. And that comes to 22 minutes a day. Yeah. When we get our police doing a minimum of 22 minutes per day of moderate physical exercise, we reduce between 60 and 70% the biggest killer of police, which is type 2 diabetes as a gateway to heart disease and stroke. We turn that around. Hmm. 22 minutes a day of moderate physical exercise. Duke University did an extensive research on depression. Hmm. They found with three treatment modalities. The first was psychotropic antidepressant medication. The second was medication plus counseling. And the third was walking on a treadmill for 20 minutes a day. All three groups eliminated the depression. So by putting our cops into mandated moderate exercise mm-hmm. for, let's say, a half hour per day, we will reduce the depression load, we'll make turns on the corner on suicide, and we'll also start lowering the physiological impact of post-traumatic stress disorder. So the second thing, first is keep the calendar. The second thing is having moderate exercise. You can put extreme exercise if you want, yeah. but so many of our cops become sedentary off duty. They get incremental weight gain yeah. and they die prematurely. So exercise every single day, 22 minutes per day minimum. And the third and final thing that I would beat cops up with was taking a look at the dimensions of their life. What are the other roles? You know, cops don't say, I work as a cop. They say, I am a cop. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You should be proud of saying, I am a cop. But you're also a spouse.
Yeah.
You're also a dad. You're also a bowler. You're also a fly fisherman. You're also a mountain bike rider. And understanding that those other roles are what will balance and make you a better cop in the long run. Mm-hmm. I have seen so many police spend their 25, 30 years in policing. They're world-renowned homicide detectives, but that's all there are. And when yeah. they leave the police role, there's nothing else there.
Right.
Or understanding, in order to maintain mental health, you have to have the majority of things in your life in your control. And when the majority of things in your life are controlled by the police department, it's out of your control.
Right.
And then you have cops get really angry about some idiotic issue like a hat policy or some ridiculous issue like this, yeah. and you don't recharge the batteries. This is one of the biggest cross-cultural issues I see between American cops and Canadian cops or Australian cops. The American cop, by far, gets very little vacation time, virtually none. It's not uncommon for me to find Australian cops with 7 to 9 weeks vacation per year. And a sabbatical on an 80-20 split, they can take a year off and be compensated.
Wow.
We don't do that in the United States.
No.
We'll do it for some professor down here at the university. But so some 23-year-old for the next 30 years could be knocking on doors telling people that their child's dead.
Right.
Or dealing with fentanyl overdoses or, you know, sexual assault victims, and do that until you're 50 with a couple of weeks here and there off. That's why we destroy our police. So yeah. To me, keeping the mandated calendar, the second is every single day religiously doing that 30 minutes, I don't care, walk 15 minutes one way
right.
and come back. And 22 minutes is the minimum that the Center for Disease Control tells us. And the third is looking at your life, taking a good inventory, and having all those other roles in your life. So when I become your chief of police and I mandate some hat policy at 9 o'clock at night, you're not still pissed off about it and texting your BFF about what an idiot I am, that you are in fact right. going over your son's reading level or you're going for a walk with your spouse. That's what matters. And in the long run, when our cops do just those three things, and you mentioned this entity you went to had all these things cops could do. That's those other roles. Work on your bowling. Work on your weightlifting. Become a barbecue chef. And then you're thinking about cooking those ribs. You're not thinking about my idiotic hat policy.
Right.
You're not letting idiots live in your head rent-free.
Right.
And and that's what happens to police officers. They lose the things in their personal life. Then the idiots live in their head rent-free. And eventually some 30-year-old cop goes out and takes his or her life. And that's such a tragedy of policing.
Yeah.
Those are job-related injuries, and we need to do more about it.
Yeah. All right. We'll take a break. Okay. So we're back. We just took a short little break. But ultimately, I'll say it again, I appreciate your time. I'm painfully aware that as we get older, our biggest commodity is our time. And so I'm always grateful that my old friends and new friends are willing to come and hang out with me and share some time.
Well, you know, you're a lot younger than I am, so time is a lot more precious to me than it is to you. I don't, you know, I'm on the exit line, but no. But, you know, I appreciate what you're doing.
Yes, sir.
Trying to take some experiences, have the cops voice their experiences, and, you know, pay it back for the other people. And, you know, one of the things that I find a lot, I get called in after tragedies. I just get called in routinely. I worked 9/11. I worked Hurricane Andrew, worked the Boston Marathon bombing, worked the Oklahoma City bombing, and getting called to those scenes and dealing with departments that lose officers. I have a steady diet of that across the states, going to them and getting called. But you'll hear people that have lost a dad or a mom, they'll say, I would like to get some stories about, do you know anything my dad did?
Yes.
You worked with my dad. Can you tell me some stories about what he did or what my mom did during her career? So, you know, you're putting this together for a legacy project.
Yes.
It's a legacy
absolutely.
Project.
Absolutely.
And those take time. And so it's interesting to do those. You know, there's one legacy project, and I wish I could remember who's doing it. It's a video project. And they interview cops at the academy, and they give them 5 questions. They tape video record them. Then they bring them back at the 5-year point, and they ask them the same questions. Same person.
Yeah.
They bring it back at the 10-year point. And it's probably post-15 years project right now.
Yeah.
It's amazing to watch the transition of these men and women as they go through their careers, not just in what they say, but in what they look like.
Yeah.
You know, my life's work is to try and help police stay psychologically and physically together, physically healthy.
Yeah.
And the more years I'm at this, and I've been at it a lot of years, there isn't really any difference between being physically healthy and being psychologically healthy. They're all the same.
Yeah.
It's what they're hand in hand.
Yeah.
And so that's looking at all of those issues that we spoke about.
Well, if anyone was looking to find your book, Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement, where do they go?
Well, I would advise them to go to Amazon.com and to buy a new copy. Because the reason I say that is that book has sold millions of copies,
yeah.
and it has been pirated by counterfeiters in China.
And oh, my God.
We're selling hundreds of thousands of copies a year into the United States. So we have gone through a relationship with Amazon and have a an exclusivity store mm-hmm. that they can only buy legitimate books right now. So if you buy a used copy of the book, rest assured it's probably a counterfeit book and you're putting money into criminals' hands. If you buy a new copy of that book, it's going to be listed with a group called Hope for Heroes. And that's a group out of Delaware mm-hmm. that handles all of our book products, and they donate a significant amount of funds to police projects and charities and things. But Hope for Heroes, Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement, and it's the revised edition with the yellow ribbon across the front of the book.
Gotcha. I'm sure someone from the federal government's helping you sue China to get all your money back.
Oh, yeah, sure they are. Yeah, yeah, they're just jumping right to the front of the line. Yeah. You know, the realities are that they do nothing, absolutely mm-hmm. nothing. The intellectual property theft is every day.
And yeah.
Any time you buy a book, you can just rest assured that there's a good chance it's probably a counterfeit book. So you really have wow. to be, when you're buying books on the internet, you really have to look at the quality of control. The yeah. internet has just become a swap meet for stolen property. And I'm serious on
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And that's why we have fought for 5 years to, it's registered, there's a registered trademark, it's patented, and so we defend that. So when I say, if you're interested in buying the book, you can purchase it at Amazon, but buy a new copy. If you buy a used copy, you're probably buying a counterfeit book.
And now, because I would imagine, I know from looking at Buzzsprout that people all over the U.S. and all over the world listen to the podcast. So if someone's interested in bringing your organization to their department in order to provide training, where do they look for that?
Well, if they just type my name, and then mm-hmm. it'll come up with our organization.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, if it's a place that has great fishing, I'll probably go do it. If it's a place in the middle of the desert someplace, we'll have one of our other instructors yeah. show. And I say that facetiously, but I spend so much of my life in airports and flying to places. And I enjoy meeting the cops and training them, but I've been doing it for 30 years since my law enforcement career and in retirement. So we have some really good
young
instructors.
There's got to be some fringe benefit.
Oh, there's one. We have just wonderful instructors in our group, and they'd come out. And one of them actually 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago was just appointed the chief of the Portland, Oregon Police Department, the new chief to come in to reverse that department, which means we're down one instructor, but our other guys don't mind that because they get out and do seminars. So we're quite busy, but we try to keep up with all the inquiries that we get.
Well, sir, I think I know that this episode is going to be a little different than what I typically have, but again, in the spirit of embracing, getting the knowledge out there of how people that are in law enforcement or firefighting or paramedics, people that are first responders, even veterans, it's important to me that they understand or that they know about ways to prolong their life. Because I always jokingly say that, my plan is to make the state pay me for another 40 years after I retired. It's the least they could do.
It is. That's a good plan to have and to take it seriously. And that's not going to happen unless you're out there on the street sweating. The more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war. And that's important. That's important.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for hosting me. I appreciate the chance to speak with you this morning.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
We're sorry. The number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Thank you guys for tuning in. I appreciate you. Please come see me on Facebook or Instagram at CP_SFAF. And please check out my book, My Rookie Memoir, A Father's Legacy. It's available at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. And it's also available as a Kindle ebook. I appreciate you, and we'll see you in another week.